I want to, in the beginning, lay down a few basic principles, maybe guidelines, for the approach to this study of Israel in prophecy. First of all, I think it is absolutely impossible to have a comprehensive understanding of prophecy without having a pretty good understanding of history. If you don't know what has already happened to Israel, you're going to have a difficult time understanding what lies ahead for them, what's taking place regarding that nation now. And so history is important to prophecy. In fact, a lot of what is now history was one-time prophecy. I remember, I'm not as old as I may look, but I remember when the nation of Israel was established. I remember when there was no nation of Israel. And the establishing of that nation, as we shall see, was a fulfillment of prophecy. That's a matter of history now. They're celebrating their 30th anniversary this month there, and that is a celebration of history. But it was one-time prophecy. So it's necessary to understand history to understand prophecy. Another thing that I think, my comprehension at least of prophecy and the nation of Israel, is that Israel is the calendar of prophecy. I think you'll find that all prophecy revolves around the people of Israel. I say the people of Israel because there were several centuries when there was no nation of Israel, but the people were still there. Even during the Gentile period, prophecy was revolving around God's dealing with the nation of Israel. If you want to know where we stand at any given point on the prophetic calendar, see how God is dealing with the people of Israel at that particular time. And I think you can pretty well fit the prophetic picture into place. I approach the idea of Israel in prophecy perhaps a little differently than anybody you have ever heard, and I don't mean by that everybody else is wrong. I just mean that I think this is the way it is. I think that Israel's history, present state, and future all go back to some guidelines God gave to that nation when they came into the land to inherit it as a nation, as had been promised to Abraham. Their response to God's guidelines and God's instructions. And so for this reason, tonight we're going to be looking at what I consider the background of all of Israel's problems and troubles. God told Abraham, 12th chapter Genesis, that I'm going to make a great nation of you. He also said, many kings shall come from your loins, but I'm going to make a great nation of you. That nation was realized in the family of his grandson, Jacob. Jacob's 12 sons became 12 tribes of what eventually became the nation of Israel. When they went down into Egypt during the time of famine, it was a man with 12 sons with large families. But when they left that land and left the banks of the Nile en route to Canaan, to cross the Jordan, to come into Canaan, to inherit the land given to Abraham, they had become a rather strong people. And they were given instructions between the Nile and the Jordan, every law, every regulation that would govern the nation of Israel was given to them in that 40-year period. And these laws also had some basic guidelines that Israel was to follow in occupying the land when they came into it. And these are the things we want to look at tonight. If you will look with me, first of all, in the 34th chapter of Exodus, the borders of the land, in case you'd like to check the borders of the land deeded to them, much of which they have never occupied, but all of which they will eventually occupy, you'll find that in the 34th chapter of Numbers. But we'll be looking at the 34th chapter of Exodus first to find Moses laying down the conditions that Israel must follow in occupying the land if they're to receive the blessings of God and perpetuate themselves in that land. Let's begin at verse 12. God says through Moses, let's begin at verse 11. Let's back up to verse 10. What do you say? Let's just get the whole bit. And he said, "Behold, I make a covenant before all thy people. I will do marvels such as have not been done in all the earth, nor in any nation. And all the people among which thou art shall see the work of the Lord, for it is a terrible thing that I will do with thee. Observe thou that which I command thee this day. Behold, I drive out before thee the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. Now, take heed to thyself, lest thou make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land whither thou goest, lest it be for a snare in the midst of thee." Number one, no agreement with these people. I'm going to drive them out. No agreement with them. "But ye shall destroy their altars, break their images, cut down their groves. Every vestige of their pagan religion must go. There must be left no symbol of the paganism that is in that land once Israel has occupied the land. For thou shalt worship no other god, for the Lord whose name is jealous is a jealous God, lest thou make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they go a-whoring after their gods, and do sacrifice unto their gods, and one call thee, and thou eat of his sacrifice, and thou take of their daughters unto thy sons, and their daughters go a-whoring after their gods, and make thy sons go a-whoring after their gods. Thou shalt make thee no molten images." Well, that's pretty clear, isn't it? God says, "I'm going to drive the people out. You make no agreement with them. You destroy every vestige of their pagan religion. You don't marry into their families. The reason is simple. If your sons marry their daughters, when their daughters bow at their pagan altars, eventually your sons will bow there too. And God will not tolerate a compromise with the worship of Jehovah and the worship of the pagans. The land must be absolutely purged." If you look in the book of Numbers, chapter 33, you'll find that Moses emphasized this matter again to the younger generation that later came along. You see, as they moved across the Sinai Peninsula en route to Canaan, the Promised Land, the older generation died off because they complained about the leadership. Paul said in the 10th chapter of 1 Corinthians that they were slain in the wilderness because they murmured against God. And he said, "You take heed and don't do the same thing, wind up the same way." And so as the younger generation came along, Moses re-emphasizes these same principles. In the 33rd chapter of Numbers, let's look at beginning at verse 51. "Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, when ye are passed over Jordan into the land of Canaan, then ye shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you, and destroy all their pictures, destroy all their molten images, quite pluck down all their high places, and ye shall dispossess the inhabitants of the land, and dwell therein, for I've given you the land to possess it." Always got somebody, you know, that knows more about it than God does, and they say, "Well, that wouldn't be right. These people were in the land, and you go in there and drive them out and take their land over." You forget that many, many years before these people were born, God gave that land to Abraham, and the deed to that land with its borders is divinely recorded in the 34th chapter of Numbers. And that land belonged to these people, and the pagans that were there were imposters on a land that had been deeded to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and their seed after them. So don't charge God with not being fair with these people. Now, what happens if these people of Israel compromise these conditions? Suppose they don't destroy all the people. Suppose they let a few stay. Suppose that they do intermarry with the people. What happens to Israel? All right, look, verses 55 and 56. But if ye will not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall come to pass that those which ye let remain in remain of them shall be pricks in your eyes and thorns in your sides and shall vex you in the land wherein ye dwell. Number one, they're going to be a source of constant trouble to you if you let them stay there. A constant source of temptation. A constant source of compromise that will cause you to run into constant problems with your God. But look at the next verse. That isn't all. Moreover, it shall come to pass that I shall do unto you as I thought to do unto them. Now what he's saying is simply this. I'm telling you that I'll drive these people out of the land before you, and you can possess it. But if you compromise these conditions, if you compromise with these people, I'll drive you out of the land like I have promised to drive them out. Israel was told plainly enough that they could not continue to possess the land of Canaan if they compromised with the inhabitants of that land. Plain enough for anybody to understand. If you will look further in the book of Deuteronomy, just before Moses' death, he again warns the people of the same thing that he has warned these virtually two generations of people about. In the fourth chapter of the book of Deuteronomy, beginning at verse 23, Moses doesn't have much time left now. This is virtually his last warning to the people of Israel. And he's laying down, he's repeating the same conditions that he's hammered home again and again as they wandered through this vast wilderness. Take heed unto yourselves, lest ye forget the covenant of the Lord your God, which he made with you, and make you a graven image, or the likeness of anything which the Lord thy God hath forbidden thee. For the Lord thy God is a consuming fire, even a jealous God. When thou shalt beget children and children's children, and ye shall have remained alone in the land. While it's fresh on their mind, they may not get involved. But after you've been there a few generations, and you've been in the land a long time, and shall corrupt yourselves, and make a graven image or the likeness of anything, and shall do evil in the sight of the Lord thy God to provoke him to anger, I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day, that ye shall soon utterly perish from off the land, whereunto ye go over Jordan to possess it. Ye shall not prolong your days upon it, but shall utterly be destroyed. And the Lord shall scatter you among the nations, and you shall be left few in number among the nations, whither the Lord shall lead you. Plain enough, isn't it? If you don't keep these conditions that have been emphasized again and again, and you go into the land and you compromise the land, you compromise the worship of Jehovah, you compromise with the intermarriage of the pagans, you remember, there's no nation ever began like the nation of Israel. Most nations begin as a result of conquest, revolution, or what have you. But God made the nation of Israel by decree. And he said it's his nation. And he determined to do certain things with that nation, some of which have not yet been done, but will be done. But he tells Israel that even though I'm going to do all these things, if you compromise, you're my people. I'm doing a special thing for you. I've given you a special area of this earth as yours. But if you go into that area, into that land, and defile it, and compromise it, I'll drive you out of it, I'll scatter you among the nations, and I'll just leave a handful of you in the nations where you go. Plain enough for anybody to understand. And I submit to you that all of Israel's problems in history can be traced right back to these conditions and the way they met them or failed to meet them. And I think when we have finished that you will accept that as an established biblical fact. Now the question arises, what did Israel do about it? Did Israel do what they were told to do? Or did they compromise the land as they were told not to do? Well, it doesn't take long to find out. If you'll turn to the first chapter of Judges, it doesn't take long to find out that Israel did not keep the conditions as they had been laid down. If you look in verse 19, Judges chapter 1, verse 19, the Lord was with Judah. He drove out the inhabitants of the mountain, but could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley. Verse 21, and the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites that inhabited Jerusalem. In fact, Jerusalem was not captured and taken by Israel until David became king. They went completely through the Judges with the Jebusites entrenched there. In verse 27, neither did Manasseh drive out the inhabitants of Beth-shean and her towns, nor Taanach and her towns, nor the inhabitants of Dor and her towns, nor the inhabitants of Ibleam and her towns, nor the inhabitants of Megiddo and her towns. But the Canaanites would dwell in that land. Now look at a little trick in verse 28. It came to pass when Israel was strong that they put the Canaanites to tribute and did not utterly drive them out. They said, look, we've got them dominated. We're strong, they're weak right now, and we'll just tax them to death. Old American custom, you know. And they said, we can get a little money off of them, and we don't have to destroy them. But that wasn't what God said. God said, destroy them, drive them out, if you don't, drive you out. They didn't drive them out. Verse 29, neither did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites that dwelt in Gezer. But the Canaanites dwelt in Gezer among them. Verse 30, neither did Zebulun drive out the inhabitants of Kitron, nor the inhabitants of Nahalol. Verse 31, neither did Asher drive out the inhabitants of Arco, nor the inhabitants of Zidon, nor of Alab, nor of Atzib, nor of Helba, nor of Aphek, nor of Rehob. Verse 32, but the Asherites dwelt among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land, for they did not drive them out. Verse 33, neither did Naphtali drive out the inhabitants of Beth-Shemesh, nor the inhabitants of Beth-Anath, but he dwelt among the Canaanites. And on down you go. Not one single tribe in Israel completely purged the area that he occupied. Every tribe violated the first basic condition God laid down for possession of that land, purge the land. They didn't purge it. They compromised it. And that led to trouble, as God had told them it would, that as a result of this, they would create problems for them constantly, and under Judges, it's a constant harassment. Israel prospered. They sinned against God. The Philistines or the Canaanites or somebody came in and caused them trouble. God raised up a judge, delivered them, and he ruled them till he died, and they prospered, and over it goes again. Constant trouble with the inhabitants of the land that should have been driven out. Until finally, if you'll turn to the book of 1 Samuel, you'll find it came to something worse than this. Eventually, they did exactly what God said they would do, They were not satisfied simply to let these pagans live among them. For I told you 1 Samuel, didn't I? Chapter 8. I turned to 1 Kings, so give me a minute here. 1 Samuel chapter 8. God said if you leave them there, that eventually you'll compromise and you'll get involved in their system instead of converting them to yours. And in the days of Samuel, the last judge of Israel, chapter 8, look at verse 5. And said unto him, behold, these are the people of Israel talking to Samuel, their judge now. Behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. Why did they want a king? So they could be like the people that shouldn't have been there in the first place. They wanted a king to be like the pagans whom God said should have been driven out. He named the pagan people and told them to drive them out. But they remain. And now Israel wants to get rid of God's system of judges and enthrone a king in order that they may be like the pagans. Well, it broke Samuel's heart that they were rejecting him. And God said, Samuel, don't you be torn up about it. They haven't rejected you. They've rejected me that I should rule over them. That's the whole bit. It's not you they're after. They don't want me anymore. They want the gods of the pagans, and they want the system of the pagans. Let me tell you, friend, how many times have you heard some girl say, well, this old boy I'm going with, he's not a Christian, and he's kind of rough, but I'm going to make a good old Christian boy. I'm going to marry him and make a Christian out of him. Uh-huh. And how many times have you seen it go the other way? Let me tell you, friend, compromise never comes out on top. It just doesn't do it. And it didn't do it with Israel. They wanted a king. If you look in the 19th and 20th verses, Samuel tried to reason with them, and they wouldn't reason. They said, nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. And they said, nay, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. We don't want God fighting our battles anymore. We want a king like the pagans to fight our battles. And a king they got. They picked a doozy. They let God let them pick the first one. They picked Saul, tall, dark, and handsome. Put a crown on him, a robe on him. Said, look at our king. Stand head and shoulders above anybody. Boy, when they see our king coming, they'll know who we are now. Yeah, they surely did. He turned out to be such a disaster that God destroyed his heritage and refused to let any of his heirs ever sit on the throne. And the end result was that when God said, if you're going to have a king, I'll pick the next one. And they went down to Bethlehem. And you know the story when Samuel went down to anoint the king. And he said, go to Jesse's house. And he went to Jesse's house. And Jesse brought all of his boys by. And God said, no, Samuel's not one of these. He's not the one I'm after. Samuel said, have you got any more boys? Oh, yeah, I said, there's one little kid, towhead boy out here, minding the sheep, but he's not king material. Samuel said, go get him. Samuel had David brought by. God said, that's my man. That's my man. And David today still heads the royal line of Israel. And the royal tribe of Judah is still entrenched in Jerusalem. I'll have a great deal more to say about that as we progress during these studies. But kings brought Israel to great disaster. After David's reign, David built a mighty kingdom out of Israel. He expanded their borders to the farthest they had ever been extended, or ever were extended for that matter. Israel's dream from the days of David until this day was the restoration of the kingdom as it was under David. That's their dream. That was their dream then. That's their dream today, to have the kingdom as it was under David. And when David died, his son Solomon came to the throne, and Solomon was a young man, scared to death, and God asked him what he wanted, and he asked for wisdom and knowledge to rule this people like they ought to be ruled. And God gave him wisdom and wealth. He was the wisest king ever sat on the throne. He was the wealthiest king that ever sat on the throne. And things went well as he ruled Israel as a young king with the help of God. But Solomon, you see, with the pagan king came the pagan harem. And David had his harem. Solomon had his harem. And with Solomon, with his wealth and his fame spread all over the region, every king in the area, including the Pharaoh of Egypt, threw his daughter at Solomon's feet to try to get Solomon to marry his daughter. He wanted some contact with this wise and wealthy king. And Solomon yielded most of the time. He married practically every one of them, including the daughter of the Pharaoh of Egypt. And that brought the downfall of Israel. Turn to the book of 1 Kings chapter 11 with me, if you will, and find the disaster that came. I want you to keep your eye on focus now. Remember what has brought us to this point. The fact that Israel did not keep the guidelines that God laid down for them when they came into the land. They compromised the conditions of possession. And it brought them finally to a king that has married every pagan into every pagan tribe that was to have been destroyed. Look in 1 Kings chapter 11. But King Solomon loved many strange women. Some of us have loved one strange woman, but Solomon loved a lot of them. Together with the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Zidonians, and Hittites. Now listen. Of the nations concerning which the Lord said unto the children of Israel, ye shall not go into them, neither shall they come in unto you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their God. Solomon clave unto these in love. You know the story. We'll not have time to go into detail with it here tonight, but you're well acquainted with the story. As a result of this compromise, Solomon built altars, eventually pagan altars to the pagan gods of these pagan wives, right out on the Mount of Olives, looking down over the temple area. There's pretty strong indication here that Solomon bowed at these pagan altars. Some of these gods were deeply involved, sisters were deeply involved in sex worship and human sacrifice. And Solomon built altars to these to appease his pagan wives. That's exactly what God told them would do if they married into these pagan people. And now the king of the land has set the pace. And the result is, as you are well aware, God came to Solomon and said, I'm going to divide the kingdom as a result of it. I'm going to tear it asunder. There were two acts of mercy granted. If you will look in 1 Kings 11 and continue to read, one was that the kingdom would not be divided in Solomon's lifetime for David thy father's sake. It would be divided in the lifetime of Saul's son when he came to the throne. And the second act of mercy was that the kingdom would not be wholly taken away for Jerusalem's sake. God had promised David that Jerusalem would be a perpetual city where God would meet his people. And so for Jerusalem's sake, the whole kingdom would not be taken away. But when Rehoboam, Solomon's son, came to the throne, Jeroboam, who had already been involved in rebellion against the people and fled to Egypt temporarily, took advantage of the rebellion against Rehoboam and came back and took 10 of the 12 tribes away from Solomon's son Rehoboam and established the northern kingdom. The first thing he did when he established the northern kingdom was to realize that if they came back to Jerusalem to worship, they would soon become attached to the southern kingdom. And he couldn't stand that. So he built a couple of golden calves. He called the people of Israel together and he said, these are the gods that brought you out of Egypt. You'd think they'd say, oh, you think you're kidding. No, they didn't say a word.
They just bowed down and worshiped. Now listen, 10 of the tribes have been torn away from Judah. A new kingdom in the north has been established, and idolatry has been enthroned as the state religion because they didn't drive out the pagans in their religious system when they came in. And the result of this, if you'll look in 2 Kings chapter 17, verses 22 and 23, you'll find that that kingdom went deeper and deeper into idolatry until finally the Assyrian Empire, the old barbarous king with his throne in Nineveh, marched against the northern kingdom of Israel and took it. And the people of northern Israel were taken captive into the land of the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers, the land of the Chaldees. You'd think that the southern kingdom would see this and would tremble and would straighten up and fly right, so to speak. But Jeremiah says in the third chapter of Jeremiah, verses 6 and 8, that Judah, her treacherous sister, saw what northern Israel had done in playing the harlot. She went and did likewise. And the southern kingdom continued to go deeper and deeper into idolatry until finally in 2 Kings chapter 25, you'll find that Jerusalem and Judah fell to Babylon, and their people were taken captive in the land of the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers and the land of the Chaldees. And Jerusalem has been reunited, but as captives, a long way from Jerusalem and their beloved city. And the scripture says that they hung their harps on the willows along the Euphrates and wept because they could not sing a song in a strange land. Why are they here? Because God told them plainly that if you compromise and don't purge the land, if you intermarry with these people, I'll drive you out of the land. You can't stay there and compromise with these people. They compromised, and now they're out of the land. And their land is overrun by strangers again. It's true that after some time, Israel, a remnant of the people, did return to Jerusalem and to the land of Israel, primarily to the Jerusalem area, led by Nehemiah, Zerubbabel, Ezra, and these brethren who still had a burning in their heart to get back to their land and to the beloved city. They rebuilt the walls of the city of Jerusalem. They rebuilt the temple in Jerusalem. And the people, a remnant of them, returned. Most of them had grown up in this pagan land and had gotten involved in business there, and they were pretty well satisfied there, and they stayed there. They didn't choose to come back when they were given the opportunity. But the remnant who returned also returned to their sin. You'd think you would have learned their lesson, but they didn't. They rebuilt the walls. They rebuilt the temple. But I want you to turn with me to the book of Nehemiah, the last chapter in Nehemiah's writing, and I'll tell you, you can't believe what's happening here. Nehemiah had worked so hard to get the temple worship established and to get the people of Israel back in tune with God, get the Levitical priesthood in order. And in verse 23, in the 13th chapter of Nehemiah, Nehemiah says, "In those days also I saw Jews that had married wives of Ashdod, of Ammon, and of Moab." What? That's what caused them to be coming back to Jerusalem and rebuild it. They had been driven out of the land because they had intermarried with these people. And before Nehemiah gets the new temple completely set up and the worship completely established, they're already doing the very thing that caused them to be dispossessed of the land in the first place. And he goes on to say, and their children spake half in the speech of Ashdod and could not speak in the Jews' language, but according to the language of each people. That's the way it always happens. No, you're going to compromise with error, because you think by compromising you'll be able to win error. But instead you wind up speaking the language of Ashdod and you forget the language of the Jews. That's what happened to Israel. Israel did return. They had their temple, they had their city. But Israel's glory was gone. Never again did they have a king on the throne of David, reigning over the kingdom of Israel, as in the glorious days of David and the early days of Solomon. They were ruled by a political priesthood that came to be a political appointee. By the time the Son of God was born into this world as Israel's Redeemer, they didn't want a Redeemer. They were closing their eyes to all that the prophets had said about the Lamb of God to come. They wanted a king that would take away the Roman yoke and reestablish the empire of David and give them a great king again. And so they rejected their own Messiah when he appeared on the scene, because they didn't want a sacrifice for their sins. They were only interested in their political welfare. This is what compromise had done to Israel. And it's what compromise will do to any life of a child of God that tries to compromise the Word of God, compromise the principles of Christianity, and think he's going to gain. He'll wind up loser every time. It never fails. The price of compromise comes high.